The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I remind you before we jump into the heart of our show that today is the birthday of Curtis Mayfield, who was born in 1942 in Chicago, one of the great singers of all time, and those of us old enough to remember For Your Precious Love and the impressions that he sang, and then went on to become one of the great, what they called, message music singers, Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder and others, but he really led the pack, and talked about the consciousness of people and about changing the society and making changes for the people and making changes for people of color in America. One of the most important singers we've ever had in America. And, of course, was tragically paralyzed and the neck down when a lighting fell on him doing a performance, but practicing for a performance. And then he left us in 1999. But today is the birthday of Curtis Mayfield, and we want to remember him and all he's done for all of us in this society. Right now, we're going to turn to our show, and for the first part of our program, we're going to be talking with the 7th District Congressman, Elijah Cummings. And Congressman Cummings, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Mark, it's always my pleasure.
Always good to hear your voice. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888 as we talk with Elijah Cummings. You have two really interesting bills that you are working on in Congress. Let's talk about them. Let's talk about the issue around violence and protecting witnesses, and what the federal government can do, and what is this bill that you're working on with others in Congress?
First of all, Mark, it's called the Witness Protection Bill, and basically what we've got is a situation in Baltimore and throughout the country where witnesses are being threatened, harmed, and in many cases killed because they simply want to do their duty, and that is cooperate with the police or testify in a trial or what have you. And we've seen it over and over again in our own city. And so basically what this bill does is it gives people like Patricia Jessamy, our state's attorney, and others on the local and state level an opportunity to get funds from the federal government to not only protect witnesses but to assist them. What is happening is that witnesses today, and well, state's attorneys don't have the resources to even assist a witness. And for example, if a witness needs to be taken out of a certain neighborhood for a period of time until they testify, a lot of them don't have the money for that. Sometimes they need somebody just basically to assist with regard to babysitting or get some kind of babysitting tours done while they're testifying, things of that nature. But more significantly, we need protection. And so what we'll do, what this bill does, is it allocates $150 million over the course of 5 years to jurisdictions, mainly jurisdictions that have at least 100 murders over the previous year. And they are then able to compete for funds at there'll be $30 million available each year nationally, and they can use this money to protect and assist witnesses so that we can get to trials. What's happening right now is that a lot of trials, we never even get to hear cases. The cases never even get to trial because witnesses are, again, threatened, harmed, or killed. And so if you don't have the cooperation of witnesses, there's no way to prosecute a case. You just can't do it.
So how much money would a city like Baltimore get?
It all depends. It would be competitive. Baltimore could possibly end up with, we have not set the limits on it because this would have to be determined by, the bureaucrats that will review it. But it's quite possible that Baltimore could get anywhere from, say, $500,000 to $1.5, maybe $2 million. It all depends. And so, as we saw in today's paper, sadly, we had the number one murder rate in the country, and although we've made tremendous progress, so Baltimore would be right up top there with regard to competing for funds of this nature. And the other thing is that we could actually show that we are unable to take a number of very serious cases to trial because of witness intimidation. So basically, I mean, you've got two major things in your favor, although we don't like, I don't like the idea that those are, you know, those are elements that would open the door for us to get the grant. The fact is that they're present, and I think that it would bode well for us in an effort to get money.
And I mean, how soon would this go into effect if it passed?
Well, it would go into effect as soon as October, and in the new fiscal year. And so, this is something, Mark, I've been working on for a number of years, and it's finally, you know, when you're in the legislative process, one of the things that you discover is that sometimes things you can push and push and push on an idea, and nobody seems to be paying attention. And then suddenly its time comes. And I think this is what has happened to this legislation. It is now passed out of the committee, which was the most important thing, and it'll be on the floor of the House next week. We expect it to get probably pretty much a unanimous decision with regard to the House. Ben Cardin will be helping me on the Senate side, and I think we'll do very well there, and we'll move it along. And so, again, we're trying to, you know, right now, Mark, you can have a situation where you can be standing on a corner in Baltimore and in your neighborhood, and somebody can come and, God forbid, blow your brains out, and 20 people watching it, and nobody will testify.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody.
People
are terrified to testify. And keep in mind that every time that a person does not testify, that makes the, what it does is it causes the perpetrators to be even bolder because they know there are no consequences. And when you have no consequences to crime, then you have a ruthless society. You have no order. And I think, and we're now beginning to see, Mark, something that they talked about when I was in Colombia, South America, where you've got judges being threatened, prosecutors being threatened, and of course, some kind of way, we've got to get control of this.
We're going to be talking about some of that tomorrow, which is the crime rise in Baltimore and the general tenor of violence in the city that really has to be addressed. And I think there's no easy answer, but I think that that's a conversation for another day. We'd love to have you on for that sometime soon as well. You have another bill you're working on that I'm really interested in, which is the bill that would try to stem some of the mortgage defaults happening.
Yeah, what we're doing this coming Saturday, Mark, is we are trying to help some people stay in their homes. We have a lot of people who are losing their homes for several reasons. One, people losing their jobs. Two, there's been a lot of people got caught up in this subprime situation where they were a victim of predatory lending. And others now find themselves in a situation where the economy has put them in a place where they're what's called underwater. That is, the value of their home has gone down, and they're actually paying more for the home than it's worth, and so they really have no equity, and it's almost impossible to refinance. And so the president has done some things to try to get the mortgage companies to work with borrowers and homeowners that may find themselves in trouble, but it has not been working as fast as we need it to work. And so what we've done, what we're going to do on this coming Saturday at Morgan State University from 9 till 3 is we are going to have 19 of the lenders from the Baltimore area, that is people who, companies like Citigroup and others, that hold mortgages. And then we're going to match them up with folks who may be borrowing from those companies but are finding themselves in difficulty and are either about to go into foreclosure or in foreclosure, and try to help them. And we've this is a major project, and we expect hopefully that we're going to have at least 500 or 600 people who are going to actually be able to sit down with lenders and try to work out some type of arrangements where they can either reduce the principal, reduce the interest, string out the payments a little longer, but try to make sure that the monthly payments are smaller so that they can stay in their homes.
So where is this going to take place?
So Morgan State's School of Engineering from 9 until 3 this coming Saturday, from 9 until 3. And I'm asking people to call our office, Mark, at 410-685-9199, 410-685-9199. And we want them to pre-register. The reason why we want them to do that is so that we can, so that the mortgage company will have their records before they even get there. So when they sit down to meet with the mortgage company, we can be most effective and efficient. Will we be able to save everybody's house? No. We're going to do the best we can, though, because there's one group that I'm really worried about, Mark, and that's the group that has become unemployed. See, if you got a paycheck, I think we can work it out. But if you don't have a paycheck, that's a problem. And that's one of the things that we're going to do as a result of this. We're going to see how much success we have on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm turning to the president and saying, Mr. President, these are people that have done the best they could. Many of them are losing their homes through no fault of their own. We've got to figure out a way to do more. And so, again, most of the Congress people around the country are doing events like this. But most of them only have 3 or 4 lenders appearing. We've got 19. We've got 95% of all the lenders that would have an effect on our district. So a person has a 95% chance of coming in contact with a lender that they are borrowing from.
We will have all that type of information on the website, Congressman, and and the office number again is 410-685-9199 to register for the event this Saturday at Morgan State University's School of Engineering.
And it's free, by the way.
It's free. That Congressman Elijah Cummings has set up to meet with lenders to deal with mortgages. You may be in danger of losing your home, to sit and talk with lenders to work it out. And Congressman Cummings, thanks for all your work.
Thank you. And by the way, thank you for recognizing Curtis Mayfield. I really appreciate what you do, because I think so often we need to be reminded of the history of the great folk that have come upon this earth and had such a tremendous impact. I really appreciated you opening up this segment with that.
Thank you, Elijah. It means a lot.
All righty.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break and come right back to talk about what's going on in Detroit and the bailout of GM. And people say a government takeover of GM, but what does it all really mean for the rest of us and for the future of auto in this country? We'll be joined by Steve Isberg in studio here, and Robert Wiseman joining us by phone. Come with us at 410-319-8888. We'll be right back for that. And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And that, my friends, is Curtis Mayfield. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about Detroit and the bailout by the federal government, and the federal government owning a huge piece of General Motors and Chrysler, and the question of whether this bankruptcy was avoidable. How does this fit into the general scheme of the future of our country? How many cars are now going to be made overseas in China and not in America? What was the bailout for? Do you have to have the layoffs and closures? Was that necessary? Part of this package? We're going to talk to our guest and to you about all that in the next 45 minutes or so. Steve Isberg's in the studio. He's a finance professor at the University of Baltimore. Always good to see you, Steve.
Good to be here, Mark.
Robert Weissman joins us by phone. He's writes for the Huffington Post. He's co-director of Essential Action, a corporate accountability group based in Washington, D.C., and is editor of the Multinational Monitor magazine, which tracks corporate activity, especially in the developing world. And Robert Weissman, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to jump right into your thesis, Robert Weissman, you've been writing about it for a while, and that you wrote about it just recently, questioning the question of whether this bankruptcy was necessary, and was this the way to turn around Detroit?
Yeah,
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that the bankruptcy was discretionary by the administration in a lot of ways. I mean, with the government putting in up to $50 billion into GM, it's put in enough that it could handle the GM restructuring however it chose. The purported rationale for bankruptcy was a problem of dealing with these bondholders who held $27 billion in bonds from General Motors. But by the end of last week, they had worked out a deal with a majority of them and were on path to get a deal worked out with a sufficient number that they could have avoided bankruptcy. But they chose to go into bankruptcy anyway. So I think they decided this was a cleaner way to do their restructuring. But from our point of view, it makes a lot of moves irreversible and locks in a lot of really harmful decisions that the auto task force made that's been guiding the restructuring of General Motors.
And those are the things I want to come to in some detail here. Steve Isberg, I mean, what's your perspective? Was there a way to do this without filing bankruptcy?
Well, if you eliminate, for the moment, the presence of the government, this company goes into bankruptcy quite a ways back. I mean, it has been in a state of technical bankruptcy for several years. Its assets have been shrinking. Its cash flows haven't been sufficient to cover its liabilities. Had the government not stepped in last year, then the creditors would have essentially foreclosed on the company and virtually forced it into bankruptcy. The fact that the government stepped in actually deferred the bankruptcy that would have taken place under normal market conditions. So I would disagree a little bit with what Robert said.
Well, one of the things you pointed out, Steve, early before we started the show, was you gave me a chart showing the General Motors monthly stock price and how at the turn of the century, it has just plummeted over the last 9 years, literally plummeted.
Correct. Yeah, the equity investors in GM have seen this coming for the last 7 years. You know, when the last recession hit, the recession prior to the current situation, right around the end of the year 2000, GM's profits took a hit, their sales took a hit, and they never really came back from that. Yeah, you know, they had a little bit of what you might call a recovery after 9/11, but a lot of the recovery that they experienced was fed by the Federal Reserve pushing money into the system after 9/11 to keep the economy going. They most likely would have hit a financial distress situation much earlier had that not happened.
And Robert Weissman, I mean, I'd like to kind of explore these alternatives, that what might have happened instead from your perspective. I mean, I question Mr. Deese, who runs this auto task force for President Obama. And the question, I think one of the things we should be asked and can look at is, I mean, has anybody done any kind of real cost-benefit analysis of what this bankruptcy means for the nation, for GM? We closed 14 GM factories, 7 alone in Michigan, immediately a loss of 21,000 jobs, 6 figures more jobs that look like they're going to be lost because of all the other industries are going to be affected. This could lead to housing foreclosures, unemployment, tax revenues lost, suppliers closing, dealerships closing. 100,000 people could lose their jobs just in dealerships. So I wondered, Robert Weissman, what would have been the alternative to what just occurred from your perspective?
Well, there's two separate pieces to it. One is, could they have avoided bankruptcy? And I agree that the company would be insolvent but for the government money. But bankruptcy is not just a matter of what would have happened but for the government money. The government money was coming in, and there was a decision made about whether to enter this legal regime, which has certain consequences. So that's one question. A separate question is, what's the overall plan by the auto task force, and what decisions are they making? And the answer to your direct question is, were they subjected to any kind of cost-benefit analysis? And I think the answer is certainly no. From the task force's point of view, they were making decisions that they thought were necessary to get the company back to profitability. But I think they did a number of things that are questionable unlikely to be necessary to help deal with the company's profitability. And there are other things that they did where, given that the government is now the majority stakeholder, the majority stockholder in the company, they should have applied a different calculus rather than just profit, no profit, and looked at whether, as exactly as you're suggesting, the social costs outweighed the private benefits. So to give a couple examples, they're closing a few thousand dealerships, which have only the most tenuous connection to the auto manufacturers' profitability. But that itself is going to cost more than 100,000 jobs. So that's a massive spread across the country impact in a time of a deep recession. So I think a really poor decision. I think there's a lot of reason to question whether they needed to close as many factories as they did or to allocate the closures in the way they did. They're aiming for profitability in a market with 10 million auto sales. There's really good likelihood that auto sales will be considerably above that in the non-immediate term. We're at 9.5 million right now, but as we come out of the recession. They forced the United Auto Workers to accept massive cutbacks in their wage and benefit levels, especially for new workers, where they're setting up a new system a system that's going to have new workers come in at about half the wages of old workers, and it's going to basically mean that new jobs in the auto industry are no longer a ticket to the middle class. And then among the most cruel and discretionary moves that they've made in the Chrysler rescue and appear poised to make in the GM rescue as well is to shut off the claims of victims of defective products sold by these manufacturers so that they're unable to sue in court at all to recover for the injuries that they have been inflicted upon them and in some cases the deaths that family members have suffered.
So, Steve, let me ask you to comment the same thing, and the question I throw to you, and I'm sure Robert will comment on as well, is it who is this bailout benefiting? Is it benefiting the nation? Is it benefiting the people who are employed by GM? Or is it benefiting only the shareholders and the people who own GM to keep them from sinking entirely on our backs?
Well, the shareholders have gone bust. I mean, as you can see from the stock market price chart there, when the stock just topped out at $65 a share in 2000, that was it. And since then, it's plummeted. And the shareholders have been getting out. And anybody who's bought that share in the last year has basically bought it on a bet and, you know, hasn't paid a high price for it and probably doesn't mind losing the bet at this point. They're probably saying, all right, it didn't work. Let me go back and put some of the comments that have been made in different contexts and talk about some of the seemingly huge compensation hits that the United Auto Workers members are taking. There's a history here, and the history goes back to the 1980s, actually. And prior to the 1980s, we had a domestic automobile industry primarily made up of the big three, and then we had the German companies and the Japanese companies who were importing just about everything that they made and sold here. They weren't making cars here. As the events turned, when the OPEC embargo struck, increased the price of gasoline, now all of a sudden the smaller cars that the Japanese and Germans were making look more efficient. People start buying more of them. By the time we hit the 1980s, the big three are in deep trouble. Chrysler's getting bailed out with a federal loan guarantee. GM's losing market share. Ford's losing market share. Mid-1980s, they cry out for protection from this foreign invasion, and they get it. They get it in the form of quotas, tariffs, import protection. They get it in the form of CAFE standards because the CAFE standards were set up so that only cars produced in the United States counted. And their claim was, you know, that they were up against foreign companies that were subsidized, that had lower labor costs. And the reality was in the 1980s, manufacturing was moving offshore. It was in the international market. It was seeking locations where wages and costs were lower, and the fact that we could transport bulk goods over longer distances more efficiently enabled that. And the U.S. auto industry sought to protect itself from that. Well, the Toyota Honda's response to that was, okay, we got all these dollars. Let's come to the U.S. and build manufacturing facilities in Tennessee and Georgia and South Carolina, incidentally, where the unions aren't as well protected. They set up non-union shops. They brought a completely different compensation plan into those facilities. And you had a new domestic industry that was essentially made up of the old big three and the Japanese and German companies. And they were operating under two completely different structures. And the primary difference had to do with work rules and compensation. Where they were building cars down south, compensation rates were lower. Work rules were a lot more flexible. If a facility shut down because of lack of demand, the workers went home, they didn't get paid. In the Northeast, in the North, and in Detroit, if GM shut down, didn't function for several weeks, workers went home, got paid. And, you know, what ended up happening was you had this dual system at work where, you know, over time, what the big three should have been doing was adjusting, but because of the friction created between them and the union, they didn't. And now that pressure has built up to the point where, you know, an adjustment that should have taken place over 20 years is now taking place in 2 months. And, yeah, it's like dropping the frog right into the pot of boiling water instead of putting the frog into the pot of cold water and slowly turning up the heat. It's a shock.
So Robert Weissman, I'm really curious, especially in your perspective, what's the response to that analysis?
Well, my response is that it's not true. The Japanese transplants pay wages that are roughly comparable to the wages in the big three. They don't have the what are called legacy health care costs, the costs for the retirees that GM, Ford, and Chrysler have for having been invested in the United States for 100 years. But they pay roughly the same wage, and the reason they pay roughly the same wages is to avoid unionization. The new deal, which was actually embedded in the 2007 contract with GM, but is now worsened and extended with the givebacks as part of this deal, will make the new starting wages for many of the new workers at GM considerably below the wages at the transplants. So what we're going to see is an inverse of the structural relationship we had, where the transplants kept their wages roughly close to what the union wages were to avoid unionization. Now the union wages are actually below the transplants, and it's, I would say, a near certainty that the transplant wages will fall down, the transplant being the Japanese manufacturing plants in the United States, that their wages will fall down now to the new government-enforced UAW level. And we're seeing the destruction of auto manufacturing jobs as a ticket to the middle class, and we're making them into, you know, Home Depot Plus jobs. And this is completely a government discretionary decision made worse by the fact that auto manufacturer wages actually contribute not very much to the overall cost of a car, about 10%. So you can cut the wages in half, you're still not cutting the cost of the car very significantly. It's also worth noting that the cost of the American manufacturer cars is generally below the cost of the Japanese cars. So their problem, and they do have very severe problems, I agree, is not a matter primarily of cost. It's primarily a problem of quality and the wrong product mix.
Fundamentally, that General Motors and all the other, the big three in America, didn't listen to the consumer, didn't listen to the changes in the marketplace, and instead went on the merry way building huge cars and trucks and suffered for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's no question that a massive restructuring was needed. There's no question that they had collapsed by the end of last year, that the government money was needed. I'm not disputing any of that, but I am disputing whether... I'm just stating that the government did not have to take them into bankruptcy, and I think the government has a wider range of choices about how it manages GM going forward and what terms and conditions they extracted in exchange for the new infusion of cash. And I think they're making a lot of bad decisions and signaling they're going to make a lot of future bad decisions.
Steve, go ahead, and I do want to hear from Robert what the alternatives are from his perspective. But go ahead, Steve.
Well, again, you have to be very, very careful to differentiate between compensation and wages. When I was talking about compensation packages, you need to include the health care benefits and the deferred compensation benefits. And what has killed General Motors is that accumulated liability that's been created by the deferred health care benefit and the deferred compensation, the retirement benefit. That is the essence of the bankruptcy problem right now.
If I just might throw in here, Steve, you finish your thought, but I think a historical fact is interesting here, that part of that's also GM's problem, because they're the ones who made sure that when the UAW under Walter Ruther in the late 40s said, let's have what stands amount to a single-payer system to take care of health benefits for all Americans, GM said, no, we're going to do it, and they began digging their own grave there the very same way.
Essentially, you know, and the interesting thing about that is that, you know, the market has been withholding its funds from GM for quite a while. As you can see, the stockholders started to bail out 5, 6, 7 years ago. The bondholders have been bailing out for years. They haven't added new debt. And what's enabled GM to grow is this accumulation of deferred benefits. Okay, they show up as liabilities on the balance sheet. But that, you know, that funding has enabled them to grow the company and invest in additional assets. So you talk about all these plants having to close. That expansion took place without being really supervised by the market. They weren't really accountable to the market in that case. So, you know, as far as everybody's wage falling, the other thing you got to think about here is that most of those jobs we're talking about are completely unskilled, required no real education. And if you take a look at unskilled labor rates worldwide, they're much, much lower. So, you know, if they fall even with the transplants, you know, they're falling in response to the fact that when you build cars in China, you're paying very little wages.
Well, Robert, I'll let you come in here, but it seems to me the reality is, though, that one of the most powerful things about the steelworkers union and the auto workers union and those industries is that's what built the back of the middle class in America. Without that, we wouldn't have a middle class.
An unskilled middle class.
Middle class. Their kids went to school. They went to college. They had homes, stable neighborhoods, stable families. They worked for a living 8 hours a day. Whether they had skills, whatever you ever call unskilled. I'm sorry, Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted to jump on and agree with that. I mean, first of all, there are political choices to be made about how much, and this is, you know, in the traditional arena, you had a matter of political power of the unions, whether workers are unionized and their capacity to exert power as against employers and bring up wages. Now you have a totally political choice by the government about what wage level it's going to set. These are not marketplace decisions in any sense. And I think the government is making a really horrible decision to drag down wages. It's not true, by the way, that all these jobs are unskilled. They're semi-skilled, and a lot of them are quite skilled. And more importantly, this is hard work. And it's just really wrong for people who work in professions behind a computer to denigrate the hard work, the sweat, and the unsafe conditions that people working in auto plants have to put up with and say, well, you know, it's too bad. It's unskilled. Take the $14. You don't like it. Find a new job. Train yourself something in some fantasy world. People are working hard. They work dangerously. And it is a good thing for them and a good thing for society if they're compensated at some reasonable level.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. The lines are now open. Your thoughts about the bailout of Detroit and General Motors, what's going on with Chrysler and General Motors. Was there an alternative? Is this the right way for America to go? What does it mean for our future? We'll explore in a minute the difference between this and the bailout of banks. Is there any connection there and why the structure of both these kind of bailouts was so different? 410-319-8888. You just heard Robert Weissman, who writes for the Huffington Post. He's co-director of Essential Action, a corporate accountability group based in Washington, D.C., and editor of Multinational Monitor magazine, which tracks corporate activity, especially in the developing world. And Steve Isberg is with us once again. He's finance professor at the University of Baltimore. 410-319-8888. What do you think should have happened in Detroit? Did Barack Obama and the task force that he made make the right decisions or the wrong decisions here? In looking at these bailouts, let's look for a moment before we come back to what the alternatives are in the future, because this bailout of Detroit, now this investment in Detroit of $50 billion, is only be the beginning of this discussion, I think, in battle in Washington over what this means. This is just, we're just beginning this. But let me take a step in another direction for a moment. Some people argue that the way that this administration and the previous administration have bailed out, quote-unquote, Wall Street, the large financial interests there, with very little, if any, oversight at all in terms of the money that was put in, as different to what they're doing with a manufacturing base. And I wonder what you think, start with Steve and then go to Robert, what you think the difference is here and why we have such a very different outlook on what the government's willing to do to bail out Wall Street, but not Detroit.
Well, no, I'm not sure about the direction of your question, Mark. But
I'm sure not. That's my thought. Go ahead. Take it any way you'd like.
Let me give you some insights. I think the major difference is, you know, you look at the auto industry, and a lot of people talk about how pervasive it is throughout the economy, and they've got a huge supply chain. Everybody owns a car. You look at all the people who work in jobs that are somehow connected to the auto industry. You compare that to the financial market, and that affects everybody. There isn't anybody out there who's not affected by what goes on in the financial market. So the fact that they rushed in the way they did and took action is not surprising, because it affects everybody, and there's no avoiding that. Now, we could sit here and probably have a three-hour debate on the merits of what they did versus what they didn't do. One of the interesting impacts, you know, you talked about the connection between the bailout of the finance industry and what's happened with GM, and I'll point out Chrysler. We shouldn't lose sight of Chrysler.
No.
The fact that the government put money in by way of the TARP program gave them significant leverage, if not control, over some of the decisions that these institutions were making as creditors. And when it came to the Chrysler bankruptcy, you know, typically if a company enters into bankruptcy protection, the bankruptcy laws are designed to primarily protect secured creditors. When you take a look at the order in which claims are distributed, the secured creditors are typically first in line. Employees, unsecured creditors, would be last in line. You take the U.S. Airways bankruptcy as an example. The employees lost their health care benefits. Their pension benefits were turned over to the PBGC. They're getting 10 cents on the dollar. They got nothing. So the fact that the UAW is getting what they're getting is unique, and it's unique because, you know, the government basically came in, set this deal up, told the institutions that had TARP money to get on board. And then the remaining creditors, for example, in the Chrysler situation, several creditors said, you know, we don't like this. We have rights that we can pursue in bankruptcy court, and we're going to pursue them. And then the administration made it clear, well, if you do that, you're going to take us on. And, you know, the last of the creditors basically thought, well, it's going to cost me more money to get what I'd get back. So they kind of rolled on that. And that set a huge precedent for bankruptcy. So, you know, there is an interconnection there with the government now starting to control or at least influence the decisions the creditors making in the pursuit of their own rights, the creditors' own rights.
Robert?
I think the biggest difference between the Wall Street bailout and the auto industry bailout is the relative political power of Wall Street in Detroit. And it's very different than it would have been 50 years ago. But Detroit, following the decline of its economic power, has lost the control and the grip it once exerted on Washington. And by contrast, Wall Street is everywhere in Washington, including in the decision-making positions in the Treasury Department and the regulatory agencies. You know, in the fall of last year, where the head of Goldman Sachs making the central decisions as the Treasury Secretary, and now with Tim Geithner, who is a product of Wall Street, if not not a former Wall Street employee. And if you look at all the top aides, it's Wall Street. And you think of who they consort with, it's Wall Street guys. And you think about how they look at the world, it's Wall Street guys. So for them, it was logical that they would turn over hundreds of billions of dollars and now really trillions of dollars and other kinds of supports to Wall Street with virtually no conditions whatsoever. But they don't consort with executives at the auto companies, let alone with auto employees, with auto workers. And they didn't treat them the same way. And I just think that's, at the end of the day, that's the reason that there's such different treatment. And if you look at, and just to be clear, the treatment disparity is spectacular. More money has been given or funneled through AIG twice as much as is being spent on the auto industry, and that's just one company. If you look at Citigroup, where the government supports now, if you include loan guarantees, exceed $300 billion, you're looking at three or four times as much has been spent on the auto industry. You know, and we're really looking at the same kind of situations. Everybody blames properly GM and the auto companies for bad, short-sighted management. But that's exactly the problem that we had on Wall Street. And people complain about the compensation level of the auto workers, but it's nothing compared to the average wage at Wall Street, where Goldman Sachs, for example, is like $650,000. They demand wage cuts on the auto companies among the auto workers, even though worker wages are only a small part of the total product and the company's expenditures. They don't demand wage cuts from the big Wall Street firms, even though wages are the overwhelming portion of their costs. There's just massive disparities as you go down the list, and I think it all traces back to the political power of Wall Street.
We're talking about what's going on in Detroit, the bailout, the plan by the presidential administration to go into General Motors and Chrysler. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You just heard Robert Weissman. Steve Isberg is in the studio. Let's get a caller in here, then we're also going to kind of explore what the alternatives might be to what we're seeing now, if there are there. 410-319-8888. Michael, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I kind of resent the notion that auto workers are uneducated and unskilled. And I would assert that very many auto workers, especially when I was coming up, had college education. In fact, as it is today, skilled craftsmen earn at a higher rate than do college graduates at the beginning of their careers. Many of the men who were head of households in my neighborhood provided an above middle class lifestyle to their families, working at the steel mills. They made a choice to work at steel mills and auto factories because they paid better than any of the other options, whether college educated or not. I was educated at Gilman and Friends, and my father was able to pay tuition, you know, all at once in cash, and earn much more than many of the college educated fathers of my classmates.
Michael, you raise a really very important point, and let me go both to Robert Weissman and Steven Isberg kind of respond to this. I mean, one of the things that we're seeing with the failure of our auto industry in America at the moment, and the way that it may be being restructured, I mean, is this kind of almost shock treatment for the American middle class, which is seeing the bottom fall out. And what Michael is saying is correct. I mean, I just familiarly, my first wife, still dear friends, her family were all steel workers. They worked at Procter & Gamble. They made these huge wages off the farm and from Georgia to here. And it made a huge difference in the lives of their children and this community. I mean, this is part of the crux of the issue, Robert, I think.
Yeah, I agree absolutely. I agree both that it's the case that the many auto workers and manufacturing workers are well educated, and if they're not, are still smart and savvy. There's not very much correlation between those attributes and seeking higher education. And I also think that it's almost beside the point. I mean, it shouldn't be a requirement that you are invested in higher education to make a decent wage and be able to take care of your family. And one of the good things about the American story over the last 70 years is the way manufacturing jobs help bring up the middle class. And I think one of the very bad things about developments over the last quarter century and now coming to a head in this bankruptcy is the inability of manufacturing jobs to continue to perform that function. And by the way, it is not a matter of some inevitability. It's not a matter of just, boy, globalization, that might have been good when it used to be, but it's nothing we can do anymore. Globalization has made it different. These are just political choices, and nothing makes it clearer than this government decision to cut new wages in half for no reason except that they decided to do it.
And Steve Isberg, I mean, as a both a student, professor, and teacher of finance, how do you look at this issue of what Robert Weissman is saying, that this was a political choice, that we can make different choices that build the middle class rather than destroy it? And quite frankly, just looking at it objectively, I can't see how the way we're handling Detroit at the moment is going to do anything but push more jobs overseas and create more profit for eventually GM, I think, and do nothing to build the underpinnings of working people in America, middle-class people in America.
Well, you see, here's where I'd fundamentally disagree with what Robert's saying, is that there is a certain degree of inevitability to the fact that the walls that used to protect the domestic labor market have broken down. You know, we are operating in the context of a global economy. The original impact that this had was on manufacturing. We're now seeing it in white-collar jobs as well. Engineers down in Mexico, manufacturing engineers, industrial engineers, they go to work for $20,000 a year. The same position in the U.S. Would pay $65,000 to $70,000. And, you know, where are the manufacturing facilities locating? They're going to Mexico, where they're paying the manufacturing engineer $20,000 a year and the assembly line worker $1.50 an hour. And they're just as skilled as their American counterparts would be. And, you know, even college-educated skilled individuals, you know, radiologists who read MRIs, who make $350,000 to $400,000 a year in the U.S. are now competing with radiologists in India who get paid $35,000 to $40,000 for the same work. You know, we can't bury our head in the sand and ignore the fact that that is happening. You know, the rise of the middle class in the industrial society of the 20th century was a wonderful thing. but that wonderful thing has changed, and we have to adapt to that change. That's the reality.
Steve, what you're saying is really important. So, Robert Weissman, I would ask you here to jump in before we go to our next callers, Susan and the others. Susan Holm, I'm going to come to your question. This is really important for us to understand, I think. Robert Weissman, then what would you respond in terms of what are the alternatives to what Steve is saying in terms of a government's approach to what's happening in Detroit that would affect what Steve is describing?
Well, there's a bigger debate about corporate globalization and what kind of rules we establish for the world economy. I agree that Steve described the state of affairs as they are. I don't think that's just handed down from on high. I think that's a product of the rules we establish to run the world economy, and I think we could have different rules. I think in this case, you don't have to get so abstract in general. I mean, it's very specific. The government made a decision to require as a condition of giving the money that the UAW accept for its new employees coming into GM wages that are roughly half of what workers made before, and that will not have a meaningful impact on the cost of a car. So that was just a decision that was made. It has nothing to do with the price of manufacturing in China. It has everything to do with the decision that was made by a small bunch of Wall Street expats who are operating the auto task force, who don't have any sense of the auto industry or any history in the auto industry, and made, in my judgment, a really bad imposed decision on the United Auto Workers. There are other decisions that they're making in this regard, including about whether they're going to permit General Motors to increase to manufacture overseas for sale in the United States. And the answer is they are going to permit that. The GM plans imagine exports from other countries to the United States rising from 15% of their overall sales to 23%. They may well go beyond that. They imagine producing in China for export to the United States for the first time. There is no reason for the government to permit that at the same time that it's pouring up to $50 billion or more dollars into General Motors. And the big question is, what is the purpose of saving GM if not to save the jobs and the communities and ensure a more ecologically sound future? If you're just going to let the company operate according to, with a fresh start, according to short-term bottom-line interests, you're not serving any public interest at all, and you might as well not have gone ahead and poured all the money in the first place.
So Steve Newsberg, whether the argument comes from a progressive side of the spectrum or a more conservative side of the spectrum, the question is why go into Detroit and bail them out, so to speak, in the first place, if it's not going to benefit the United States and the people who live here, but it's going to benefit the folks who really own.
Well, I think the interesting part of Robert's point is very fundamental, and that is it's not surprising to see a government entity make decisions that are not necessarily well-founded when it comes to the economics of what they're doing, which is exactly why the government shouldn't be interfering with this transaction. Now, if you take a step back, had this company sought bankruptcy protection from its creditors and had to negotiate a settlement with its creditors in bankruptcy court, I doubt that many of those UAW members would have jobs at all. A lot of them wouldn't have any kind of health care benefit or little hope of collecting any kind of retirement annuity. So in some respects, you know, you could look at what the government is doing and saying, well, this is really unfair. But, okay, is what they're getting, how fair is that compared to nothing? Because if you look at what the union members for the airlines got, a lot of them got nothing. A lot of their spouses had to go back to work to get health insurance. So, I mean, you know, you're talking about a political solution to an economic problem. And what Robert's saying is, well, the government's making a fairly arbitrary decision. Well, surprise, surprise. It's a political entity, and it's going to be politically motivated, and it's going to make decisions on a political basis. So, you know, that's exactly why they shouldn't be involved.
I completely agree. It should make decisions on a political basis. They are political decisions, so they ought to make decisions in the interest of the public, the social rationale for undertaking the bailout, not just for the short-term profitability of the corporate entity of GM, which does not even have any shareholders at this point, private shareholders, to benefit, except for the bondholders to be converted to shareholders. I mean, it's like an infatuation with the idea of profitability when there's not even an end user to benefit from the profitability at the expense of the real people who are going to pay a really high price.
Well, if this is the case, then what you've got to do is let the business go where the business is going to go from an economic point of view, which would probably be broken up for sale. And then if the government has any kind of role to play here, take the people who are displaced by this event and develop some kind of accommodation to bridge them over to the next stage in their lives. If it's a 55-year-old worker who needs support until he or she qualifies for Social Security and Medicare, then set up a program that provides that bridge. If it's a 25-year-old worker who needs to retrain for a different job, then provide them with an unemployment benefit, get them retrained, and get them on the path to another career. But don't get involved in perpetuating a company that has proven itself as not able to generate a profit.
So I wonder where you both think we go from here. And again, I apologize to the listeners who just called in and got frustrated waiting. I did want to let our guests kind of get these thoughts out. I thought they were very critical to get out for all of us to kind of wrestle with as we look at this over the coming weeks and months. Again, the number is 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Steve Isberg, finance professor at the University of Baltimore, in studio. Joining us by phone is Robert Weissman, who writes for the Huffington Post. He's co-director of Essential Action, a corporate accountability group based in Washington, D.C., and is the editor of the Multinational Monitor magazine, tracking corporate activity in the developing world. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, and we'll get back to those phones as quickly as we can before the end of the hour. One of the things that you teased us with in your last writing, Robert Weissman, the last thing I read that you wrote about this, was you were going to start writing about what could be or what the alternatives would. Could you give us an inkling into what that is without revealing everything so we can go read your article as well?
I'm not trying to hide it. In fact, I'll probably get it out as soon as we're off the call.
Okay.
I think the big decision, I just have I've got a different standpoint about how this should be handled from Steve. And I think going forward, the government should try to achieve profitability for General Motors as the controlling shareholder in General Motors. But it should also take into account overriding social objectives. And at some times, in some occasions, those will compete and conflict with achieving short-term profitability. Sometimes it's just a matter of making a different judgment, and sometimes it's a matter of thinking long-term instead of short-term. What we're seeing from the Obama administration is a statement that it wants to have a hands-off approach to GM's management, and that it wants to get out from the investment as quickly as possible. So all that's going to do is push, in my view, is push GM into similar kinds of decision-making as it's made in the past and rushing to short-term profitability decisions. Now, the price of gasoline, for example, is going up right now. But if the price were still in the $30 to $40 range and you saw suddenly no interest, diminishing consumer interest, relative consumer interest in fuel-efficient cars, and an uptick in interest in SUVs, that would drive GM to more reliance on its old strategy. And I just think that's the wrong way to go. I think what the government should do is play a much more active role, not in micromanaging the company, but in setting managerial parameters for what it does. It could right a lot of the different wrongs that I've mentioned. It could boost the wages, undo the drag down wages that it's imposed. It can ensure that production for the U.S. market is taking place in the United States, or at least that there's no increase in offshore production for the U.S. market. It can make sure that the victims of old GM cars get their day in court and have an opportunity to recover damages for the pain inflicted on them. And above all, it should insist on major investments in fuel-efficient and environmentally appropriate technologies, even if they don't have an immediate short-term payoff, because the government knows, A, that they will benefit the company in the long run, and B, that we have to change the way the auto companies operate and the products they make if we're going to save the planet from climate catastrophe.
We have about 30 seconds to a minute left. Steve, what's your last thought here?
Boy, so many things.
We'll come back to this.
There's plenty of excess capacity in the domestic manufacturing industry right now, and there are plenty of reasons to assume that even if GM were to disappear tomorrow, there'd be plenty of domestically produced cars, that industry would respond. Again, the government tool is the wrong tool to use to fix this problem. And it's a shame that so many people are stuck in the middle of this. And the government's primary role should be to care for those displaced people and let the economy do what it's going to do.
We will come back to this. I think you've both been just excellent here this hour. It's been a great conversation this last 45 minutes. Robert Weissman, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to having you on again, and keep writing and look forward to reading what you write.
Thanks so much.
Been a pleasure. And Steve Isberg, always a pleasure to have you in studio.
It's a pleasure here, Mark, and nice to talk with you, Robert.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a short break and come right back. When we come back, we'll be joined by Steve Janis, investigative reporter, and talking about doubtful deaths in Baltimore City and what that means. And then the first ever conversation between Gwen Ifill and her cousin, Sherilyn Ifill, will take place in the next hour. The Mark Steiner Show and the Urbanite Radio stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland specializing in separation and divorce and business and workplace conflicts. Located in Baltimore, go to BaltimoreMediation.com. We'll be right back.